I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Getting the facts straight isn't always easy, and sometimes it's outright perilous. We have a story for you now about someone who routinely stuck his neck out, both in war zones and also before bureaucratic institutions that often bristled at his truth-telling. Over the course of a long career, he became masterful at his job, somewhere between an anthropologist doing ethnography and a journalist embedded with troops on a battlefront. A man named Robert Gersony found himself gathering intelligence to support humanitarian aims. Gersony worked where victims suffered from natural disaster or human-perpetrated war crimes. He worked where youth were at risk of being radicalized. He worked just about anywhere his unique skills could shed greater light on any fraught humanitarian crisis. Conventional means of intelligence gathering often do not suffice at getting to the facts, getting the truth, and it probably takes a fairly unconventional person to fill that gap. Robert Gersony was more than unconventional over the course of his career. He was brilliant. And yet, were it not for our next guest, his story might never have been told for the general public. Robert Kaplan joins with us now. Kaplan is the best-selling author of 19 books on foreign affairs and travel, including The Revenge of Geography, Asia's Cauldron, Monsoon, The Coming Anarchy, and Balkan Ghosts. He's an expert in geopolitics, holding a chair at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. For three decades, he reported on foreign affairs for The Atlantic, was a member of the Pentagon's Defense Policy Board and the U.S. Navy's Executive Panel. Foreign Policy magazine twice named him one of the world's top 100 global thinkers, and his latest book is titled The Good American, The Epic Life of Bob Gersony, the U.S. Government's Greatest Humanitarian. Robert Kaplan, welcome to our show.
It's a great pleasure to be here with you.
Well, I want to begin with the fact that Gersony is still alive, and he seems to be the type of person who really doesn't want any limelight or publicity. And I'm wondering if this complicates providing a glowing account of his lifetime achievements. Has that been a problem?
Not really. You're right. He doesn't like the limelight. He's not a networker or self-promoter of the kind that Washington and New York are full of. He's just someone who does his job and wanted, his idea of attention was to set up a website about what he had accomplished throughout his life so that his children could appreciate what he had done. That was the height of his ambition. I've known Bob Gersony for a third of a century. I first met him during a coup in Sudan in 1985, in the spring of that year. And he constantly amazed me, but I did not think about writing a book about him until he casually dropped a line at a dinner we had together a few years ago that I assumed that he had gone to Yale or Harvard or Princeton. After all, he worked for the State Department for decades. And he casually dropped the line that not only did he not go to college even, he didn't even graduate high school, and that he volunteered for Vietnam, which, coming from a wealthy family in Manhattan in the 1960s, was not something you do. And so it suddenly occurred to me that here was this extraordinary life story. So I told Bob, here's what I want to do. You know, I want to go through with you every single assignment you've had, or the highlights of them, the best assignments, and then I want to interview everyone you interacted with who's still alive. And he accepted it. And, you know, and he's very pleased about the book, but he's not, to become very well known in Washington or New York or in the media these days, you've got to be a flagrant self-promoter. That's just how the system operates. And he is the opposite of that kind of person.
Well, you know, to spend a career in humanitarian-driven types of activities, I suppose there's even self-promoters in that realm.
Oh, of course there are. There really are. But you know, I won't drop any names. But no matter what field you're in, if you're not ambitious for publicity, it's often hard to get noticed. And Bob Gersony was the opposite. Throughout his career, he tended to avoid journalists, not because he didn't like them, not because he didn't respect them. And I'm talking about really true foreign correspondents out in the field, not the Washington media elite. But, you know, because he was working for the State Department or the Agency for International Development or the UN and wanted to keep a low profile at these conflict zones where there was great wars and famine, etc. And so he stayed away from journalists, though he did come to respect a handful of them. Great New York Times, Washington Post foreign correspondents, who I mention in the book, by the way. And but generally, he stayed away from the media rather than gravitated toward the media, because he didn't want his conclusions or his analysis to be conditioned by what the media was saying about a place or what even other human rights workers were saying about a place. He wanted unadulterated first contact with the evidence in the field.
So you're already getting into his methodology and his philosophy about how to get good information. We're going to go in just a moment and talk about his early life, the family he comes from, how he gets a launch into this career. But before we do that, just one more little preamble here. How do you describe his job? What was his job?
He was technically a contractor for an independent contractor for the State Department, the U.S. Agency for International Development, and the U.N. High Commissioner for Refugees. In other words, each assignment he had to be rehired. He was a freelancer. In a spiritual sense, he was a freelancer his whole life. Because to become a staff foreign service officer would have been bureaucratically restricting for him. He would have had to spend a number of years periodically in Washington. He didn't want to do that. He wanted to be out in the field all the time. And so that, you know, in technical terms, he was a contractor. In larger spiritual terms, he was sort of the ultimate foreign service officer for good.
Now, would you just kind of very quickly tick off a short list of the types of places he landed, the types of situations he found himself
sure,
in?
Sure, sure. He speaks fluent Spanish, and he did a lot of work in Central American and conflict zones in Guatemala, in El Salvador, in Nicaragua, during the decade of high superpower conflict in Central America in the 1980s. His greatest assignments were in Africa, in Mozambique, in Sudan, in Chad, in Ethiopia, in Rwanda. In some of these places, he was designing a new method for getting aid to people. In other places, he was investigating what had happened in a region, and the result of that investigation would determine how the U.S. would proceed with aid. He also spent a long time on the North Korean-Chinese border, interviewing North Korean refugees escaping from North Korea. In Mozambique, for instance, the Reagan administration was about to support an anti-communist guerrilla group known as RENAMO, and Gersony's recommendations forced the Reagan administration not to support it, and that led to a winding down of the Mozambique War. Let me just say one thing here. The Mozambique War of the 1980s and early 1990s was, by an order of statistical magnitude, several times worse than the wars in the Balkans and the former Yugoslavia in the 1990s. And Gersony more or less stopped that war in its track. and didn't become famous for it. He got credit among experts in Washington, but no more.
So where does he come from? I understand his parents were – well, I'll let you tell the story. A difficult childhood for him?
Yes, it was. His parents, his mother and father, were refugees from Hitler's World War II Europe. They were Jewish refugees, and most of their family would turn out to have been killed during the Holocaust. And they landed in Manhattan eventually. His father was a very successful business person in the commodity trade. He had a really brilliant math mind. And Gersony didn't do well in school. He had a very mild learning disorder, which was solved over the years. But during childhood, he couldn't concentrate on his studies. He didn't do well in school. So while the while all the children of Gersony's parents' friends were going off to elite colleges, Gersony dropped out of high school and then went to work in the commodity trade, which his father had taught him about, and did very well in it, but decided at the time that it was just a game, and he saw his country was at war in Vietnam, and he decided to volunteer, and he would go on to earn a Bronze Star for service, to be awarded a Bronze Star for service in Vietnam. Now, that's much inferior to the Bronze Star for valor, but it's still something. And the key thing is that the human rights community is populated by people with liberal arts minds, literature, journalism, that kind of thing. Gersony came to the human rights community with a math commodity trader mind, and that turned out to actually be a benefit, not a drawback, because so much of human rights and development in third world countries has to do with the price of crops, commodities, farming, etc. And then, anyway, after Vietnam, he drifted by one way or another. He ended up in Guatemala for just about 2 weeks, and there he met some Catholic preachers, some Catholic ministers, who had a language school, and he and Gersony learned Spanish fluently, and then with his business math mind, started and organized a network of schools teaching indigenous Mayan languages. And then came, and this is crucial, in early 1976, a great earthquake in Guatemala. An earthquake which was of historic proportions. And Gersony, knowing the country intimately at that time, devised a very ingenious way to get aid to people in remote villages. And this got the attention of the office of the U.S. Agency for International Development in Guatemala, and then they hired him, and thus began a 40-year career with USAID and the State Department, etc.
Well, going back to this idea that his education wasn't the conventional education for a humanitarian, that he comes with this commodities background, here he is after this earthquake in Guatemala, and apparently he puts his finger on a very interesting fact, that the aid community is showing up there providing the wrong kind of aid.
Exactly. The aid community wanted to give food, because if you give away food, you get donations for the food from wealthy donors in the United States. You know, they take out ads, they say, give us money for food for earthquake-stricken Guatemala. And Gersony and some of his colleagues there in the humanitarian community at the time figured out that the last thing the Guatemalans needed was food, because they had just had a bumper crop. And bringing in food from the outside would depress the prices of that bumper crop and cause even more suffering for the farmers. So Gersony and a number of his colleagues mentioned in the book said, stop sending food. Instead, sell the farmers construction materials at a reduced price and create jobs for them so they can afford the construction materials at this reduced price. And reducing the price was the element of the outside aid. In other words, don't give away anything. Make people work for it. Don't instill dependency. Try to avoid instilling dependency. And this, in other words, capitalism works, even at a low stage like this. So, and this was radical for many in the human rights community at the time.
Now, I want to get to what I think is one of the most exciting aspects of his MO, which has to do with his interviewing skills. And we're going to get to that, but I'm presuming that his analyses and those analyses based on conducting interviews, he's just kind of developing this skill and this approach there in Guatemala.
Well, he didn't develop it in Guatemala, because in Guatemala was more of an aid issue. He developed it a little bit, but it started actually in southern Thailand in 1984, and in Uganda in 1984. In other words, what Gersony learned a number of things in the course of interviewing peasant farmers in all of these places and victims of, Vietnamese boat people, victims of atrocities by Thai pirates and elsewhere. He learned, number one, treat these people with the utmost respect, because though they may be illiterate, they are experts at what had happened to them. And you, as the investigator, have to find out what had happened to them. And so you're tapping into their expertise. So always treat them very formally and in a dignified way. That's number one. Number two, find out everything about them, their family, their tribe, their village, what had happened. Identify them, but never ask for their names. That way you provide them with anonymity so that they won't get into trouble. Also, don't ask leading questions. The truth, the hard truth, the revealing truth will emerge from the conversation provided you don't ask for it directly. And be willing to spend several hours with each refugee or each displaced person. Because they won't just answer your questions and tell you what you need to know. They want to essentially tell you their life story, and you have to be willing to listen. And then the elements of their life story that are useful for your investigation will come out, but you cannot rush the process. Also, interview each person individually, singly, far enough away from others so nobody can overhear the conversation. In other words, don't interview someone with a crowd or sitting in a semicircle around them. Isolate them. And if you do enough of these interviews in great numbers, almost 400 in Mozambique in 1988, or hundreds in Rwanda in the summer of 1994, you'll arrive at a truth that you can be fairly confident of.
We're visiting with Robert Kaplan. He's author of The Good American, The Epic Life of Bob Gersony, the U.S. Government's Greatest Humanitarian. A short break next, and then we're going to talk more about the kind of temperament that it takes to conduct something like 54 assignments, 8,200 interviews with refugees and displaced persons over the course of a career. What a remarkable fellow. And we'll continue the conversation after this break on Constant Wonder. Thanks for joining with me for Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Robert Kaplan is with us to talk about his latest book, The Good American, The Epic Life of Bob Gersony, the U.S. Government's Greatest Humanitarian. Robert Kaplan, we were just talking about this interview approach. What kind of person can do this? This seems to take, I would think, number one, humility, and number two, a great discipline.
Yes, it is a great humility because you're putting yourself below, not above, refugees and displaced persons. It's someone who's comfortable with loneliness for long stretches at a time, because the only people you're going to be speaking with are people who you're listening to through a translator, who have another language. You're not going to be with fellow Westerners who you can have conversations with in the evening over a beer or a glass of wine. You're out in the field for weeks at a time with nothing but your thoughts at night to keep you company. So you have to be humble, be willing to withstand tremendous loneliness, and also be very mathematical, very methodical, because you're going to be interviewing, in some cases, hundreds. And you're going to have to put together the account of refugee number 43 in one place with refugee number 176, say, in another place. And once you have three or four corroborations, you know that something had actually happened. So there's a tremendous amount of analysis and collating material that's involved, and also working long hours, being comfortable without electricity at night. Remember, this was the 1980s and 90s, this was before the internet, before email, before Twitter. None of this existed. Nobody would really know what happened in a region until you actually physically went there and started interviewing people about it.
I want you to take us to Rwanda to describe his work there. And isn't this one of the places where his analyses kind of didn't sit very well with the United Nations authorities?
Yeah, at the time. Rwanda is what made was the most famous of the Gersony assignments within the humanitarian aid community. Because even Rwanda did not make him famous, of course, in the general public. What had happened in Rwanda simply is this. In the early spring of 1994, the Hutu government and its allies murdered in grotesque fashion around 850,000 ethnic Tutsis. So upwards close to 1 million of people died in an honest-to-goodness genocide. Afterwards, this Hutu regime was fled and was overthrown, and a Tutsi-led regime came into power in the late spring of 1994. In other words, the people who had just been killed, upwards of 1 million, were now in power themselves. And the international community naturally assumed that the good guys had triumphed over the bad guys. The bad regime, which had killed upwards of 1 million people, no longer existed, and now we have a good regime, which will right the wrongs. That was the basic conventional wisdom of the UN, of Washington, etc. In comes Gersony to travel around Rwanda for several weeks, interviewing dozens and hundreds of people individually in the way I just described, to find out what was happening. And what he found out was that now this new Tutsi-led regime was committing mass murder itself, not killing 850,000, nothing on that magnitude, but having killed between 10 and 30,000. In other words, a smaller mass murder as opposed to a great genocide. But nevertheless, this revelation about this new Tutsi regime was something that nobody wanted to hear. The UN didn't want to hear about it. The Clinton administration did not want to hear about it because it went against the grain of the policy. And the grain of the policy was to support this new Tutsi-led government. And here comes Gersony with his methodical, meticulous approach to say that the new guys in power are not angels, essentially. So he was denounced. He was, he had a lot of trouble. But over time, interestingly, over the years and even the decades, his analysis of what had happened in the wake, the mass murder of Hutus in the wake of the genocide of Tutsis became gradually the conventional wisdom of the UN, the aid communities, and the State Department in Washington. And Gersony was vindicated. He was vindicated, but it meant suffering for a number of years of being the bad guy, essentially.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Being the bad guy in the eyes of a bureaucracy of immense size, that can't feel good.
No, it can't. And it wasn't just Rwanda. Remember, he worked as a contractor for the State Department, and he uncovered early in his career, in 1984, he uncovered a mass murder conducted by a regime in Uganda, which the U.S. was supporting at the time. And though he was immediately vindicated, it was all turned out to be true what he said. He created problems in the Africa Bureau at the State Department. He was constantly coming back throughout his career to Washington with inconvenient truths. And inconvenient truths, even though they're eventually accepted as truths, don't make people happy with you. It makes them frustrated because you've made their job a little bit harder than it was before. They have to adjust the policy, change the policy, and none of this is fun to do. So that, they increasingly had respect for him and awe of him in a way, but also were increasingly annoyed with him.
Yeah, this is so weird because on the one hand, he continues to get contracts, right?
Yes, because they recognize his value. They do recognize the bureaucracy. Remember, I'm writing to a large extent about the golden age of the State Department, which was under Secretary of State George Shultz in the Reagan administration, when you had a realist foreign policy that would eventually defeat the Soviet Union, but it had a strain of humanistic idealism at the same time. So that some of Gersony's analysis got all the way up to George Shultz, and he changed policy accordingly. So this was the golden age of the State Department before the really vicious ideological battles that would erupt after the Cold War, in the wake of the invasion of Iraq, etc., occurred. But even in the golden age of the State Department, people were annoyed with him, but as you indicated, he increasingly got assignments because there was this deep respect for him.
Well, I want to go to one more region and talk about it because we're not going to get to all of the places. It was such a career, an illustrious career, actually. Take us to Gaza and talk basketball with us.
Yeah. What had happened in Gaza, this is the mid-1990s, Yasser Arafat, the Palestinian leader, had just shaken hands with the Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin on the White House lawn. This was, I think, the fall of 1993. And in the wake of what seemed to be at the time a movement towards peace and recognition of the Palestinians by the U.S. government, the U.S. government appropriated aid to the Palestinian territories for the first time. So then the question arose, well, what do you do with the aid? What do you spend it on? Send in Bob Gersony. Bob Gersony goes into Gaza, which is kind of like a Middle Eastern Soweto, just slums packed together in a sultry, semi-tropical climate, nowhere near the beauty on historical associations of the West Bank. So Gersony goes into Gaza, interviews roughly 100 people or more individually, and what he learns is to prevent a new generation of terrorists, you have to provide work for young men or things for them to do after school is out. And then he noticed there were all these unused basketball courts. And he quipped, you know, as a half joke, if you just dropped basketballs from a plane overhead, you'd soak up a lot of the potential terrorism in Gaza. You know, it wasn't a way of belittling people. It was just that you've got to provide activities for people to do. It, you know, school ends early in the day, and what are they going to do? So he basically developed a system in Gaza, which in part was providing security, night lighting for all these basketball courts, so that would and the girls could play too. They had their own leagues as well, and this, you know, it didn't solve the problem. Obviously, Gersony didn't solve any problem of the Middle East because there were larger forces at work against him, you know, larger political, geopolitical forces. But he learned in Gaza and also in the West Bank that a large part of the issue was water, potable water, how to catch potable water, how to develop, you know, filtration systems, etc., because water is the basis of life, and it's what people needed the most. So he basically told people, at the U.S. Agency for International Development, spend the money on water and work with the U.N., not against it, because they have a number of aid projects that are working quite well.
You know, we could just say that you have written a biography of an improbable hero, an unsung hero, a remarkable mind. We could go down the road of adulation all day long. I think I want to conclude my conversation with you just seeing if in the life of Robert Gersony, is there something transferable to a person like me? I'm not going to work as a contractor for the State Department or any governmental agency, but is there something I could use? Is there something any of us could use?
Yeah, he was bureaucratically very brave. He was physically very brave, but he was more importantly bureaucratically brave. And by that I mean, you know, it's all about character. It's all about judgment in any profession, whatever your life circumstances. And he determined early on that he was going to, you know, speak uncomfortable truths, that he would go where the facts led him, and then he would speak the truth, whatever trouble he got into. And that's something that's applicable to anyone.
Well, such a pleasure to have a chance to visit with you about the life of Robert Gersony. Robert Kaplan, thank you so much for being with us.
It's a great pleasure.
Robert Kaplan with us, best-selling author of 19 books on foreign affairs and such, and his latest contribution is titled The Good American, The Epic Life of Bob Gersony, the U.S. Government's Greatest Humanitarian. In the earliest days of the Christian era, saints were simply followers of Jesus Christ. The term is now more often reserved for someone who is especially saintly or full of charity and service to others. And then there are Catholic saints, whom our next guest calls the superstars of the Catholic Church. When Constant Wonder returns after a short break, we're going to hear the story of an especially saintly American war hero who may eventually become canonized in the Catholic sense as well. That's coming up. Stay with us. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Returning now to another great American, maybe even a saint in the Catholic sense of the word, Father Emile Capon was a Catholic priest, a U.S. military chaplain, heroic on the battlefield during the Korean War, and even more heroic subsequently in Chinese POW camps. Capon left such an impression on the men he served, there's actually a movement underway to have him canonized as a Catholic saint. Constant Wonder's Tenery Taylor spoke about this with Joe Drape, a sports writer for the New York Times and author of The Saint Makers, Inside the Catholic Church and How a War Hero Inspired a Journey of Faith. Here's part of the conversation they had. It touches on Father Capon's story in the Korean War, the process of making a Catholic saint, and Joe Drape's own spiritual journey.
Basically, he came in early in the war. There was about 6,000 in his battalion, and 25,000 Chinese troops showed up. It was really the emergence of China as a superpower. And it was beginning of the Cold War, communism versus democracy. He fought heroically. He had a reputation for taking a jeep through battlefields, foxhole to foxhole, carrying canteens, foods in his pockets, his crucifix, blessing people. He really wasn't too concerned if you're Catholic or not. He basically said, you know, you guys got time for a prayer. Quick prayer, moved on. Would never leave a wounded man behind. And that's where he really first got noticed. He would rush into these danger zones, load up his jeep with as many as he can carry and bring them back. Within months, however, he got captured along with 600-700 other members of his battalion in just a massacre. And the Chinese were very brutal at this point, and they really didn't want to take prisoners. And if you were wounded and couldn't go on, you were left for dead behind. Right as he got captured, a Chinese soldier was trying to put down to death a wounded soldier who had wounds in his legs and his shoulder. Father Capon pushed the Chinese soldier's rifle away, threw him on his shoulders, and said, "I'm going to carry him." And that really was the first act of defiance that rallied his fellow captors. They started picking up the wounded, and they went on this awful death march, month-long, more than 60 miles, shoes and boots taken with no clothes and sub-zero temperatures to the place called the Valley of Death, and it was subsequently named Camp Number 5. And it was there that they lived in squalor, eating barely a fistful of bird seed is all they were rationed at that. And that is when Father Capon realized that, you know, it was much more important to keep hope and faith up, and he would do by any means necessary. And if that meant going and stealing food from the guards, he did that on nighttime raids. His farm experience came in handy. He was able to build tools so they could boil water, build latrines. If medicine, he'd siphon medicine from the doctors, fake dysentery, fake symptoms, so he could get there. And more than anything, he just kept some semblance of faith and religion and hope up. And that is something that really resonated with a rainbow of people. There were Turkish soldiers there who were Muslims. There were Jewish soldiers. There were Protestants. There were atheists. But everybody rallied around this fearless priest.
And were you able to kind of get the story from their side as well to see the impact he actually had on people who then made it out?
Absolutely. And in fact, to show you the impact, when the prisoners were released in 1953, a Jewish fighter pilot named Gerald Fink led the survivors from Camp Number 5 out, carrying a cross that he had spent months building with the likeness of Father Capon. And Major Fink never even knew Father Capon. He had gotten captured afterwards, but word and legend of his many, you know, strengths and leadership had resonated that much. And they went straight to the newspapermen of that day and told the story of, you know, the most brave soldier they ever served with. And, you know, one of them had an article in the Saturday Evening Post months after he got released. There was a television show, sort of like the Hallmark Hour, that the actor James Whitmore played Father Capon.
I actually have a clip from that. It's called Crossroads. And Father Capon is kind of talking back to his Chinese captor in a courtroom setting. Here we go.
"Tell us, comrade, how many Russians have you given orders to?
Sit down. I'll have all of you punished.
What for, comrade? I'm just trying to help these men to understand the truth of your facts.
You're an obstructionist, Jew, in your church. Everything you say, everything you do.
Ever since you've been here.
Father Capone was subjected to special punishments for daring to administer to the spiritual needs of his fellow prisoners. He had defied the Red Orders against holding religious services.
So there we've got Father Capone portrayed on TV, standing up to his Red Guard captors, talking back and being punished for it. How did he eventually die there in the camp?
Well, and this resonates very deeply if you're Catholic. Being a saint requires imitating the life of Christ, living a life of such virtue that people want to imitate it. And Father Capone did imitate the life of Christ right down to his death. He had finally gotten sick and wounded. He had had a bad leg. Everything kind of went at once. And the Chinese couldn't wait to get him out and take him to what they called the death house. And that was basically a monastery where they just left you to die. And so they came for him, and his men rallied around him and rioted and trying to, you know, overpower the guards. And he said, "No, guys, how can you do this? I'm going where I want to be, and that's next to my Lord. And you guys need to just stay here and keep the faith." And as they carried him out on a stretcher, an honor guard was formed of his fellow captives. But on his way, he raised his hand, made the sign of the cross, and forgave every Chinese soldier involved there. And he finally asked the commandant who was putting him to his death to forgive him. So it really mirrored that last scene of Jesus on the cross.
Hmm. Now, there's another very important actor in your story that you're telling on the quest to make Father Capone a saint, and that is Father Hotze.
Father John Hotze.
He's what you call, what the Catholic Church calls, a postulator. Will you explain what that is?
Father John was the guy appointed at the local ground level in Wichita to gather, make the case for Father Capone as a saint, as a candidate for sainthood. And what he did was pretty remarkable. He was from that area. He had actually known of Father Capone, had a prayer card of his, was important in his life.
And okay, explain for us lay people, what is a prayer card? What does that mean?
A prayer card is a simple little size of a playing card, and it has five or six lines that asking Father Capone or whoever the saint, if it's Saint Christopher, to intercede on your behalf, to be remembered in your prayers. And, you know, Father Capone was about faith, service, and courage. Mm. And those were the three things you ask and you pray to him to help shore up with you. And Father John knew all this. He also had his master's in canon law, and that's an important component as this thing moves down the road. But essentially what he was tasked to do was go talk and gather testimony to anybody who knew Father Capone from 0 to 35 when he died. And he did such a remarkable job. And he spent 13 years doing it, and he amassed 8,672 pages of documentation on Father Capone's worthiness as a saint, as a man of virtue and a man of faith.
I want to talk about the two miracles that hopefully will qualify him for sainthood. Would you tell us those stories?
Yes, it's two young athletes, actually, which was nice parallel for my life.
Right.
Chase Kerr was a pole vaulter at a junior college in Kansas, missed the pit one day, cracked his skull literally in half. The prognosis was he wasn't going to live. He stayed in a coma for weeks. Brain swelled. His family, tight Catholic family, big parish in Wichita. They came together in the waiting room. His brothers put a Facebook page up, and the parish had prayer services to Father Capone. A couple weeks, miraculously, he wakes up, goes into rehab, has the quickest rehab ever, and he's now getting married here in the spring, works in aviation in Wichita. The second is a 12-year-old girl named Avery Gerelman, and Avery just collapsed on a youth soccer field one day. was bleeding, coughing up blood. They take her to the hospital. She spends 87 days there, mostly in a coma, on a ventilator, on kidney machines. They had no idea what was wrong with her. Eventually, they decided it was an autoimmune disease. Same thing. The family and the parish gathered. They pray to Father Capon. They basically unplug her, thinking, okay, we're going to let nature take its course here. And miraculously, she breathes on her own. Within hours, she's recognizing people. And the next day, she's talking again. And she's only ever had one follow-up appointment ever since. So, and her story is particularly inspiring because she was so moved and understood what was going on that she decided to become a nurse and subsequently went back to that same pediatric critical care unit and worked alongside nurses that had actually saved her.
Oh. All right. So just to clarify for those of us who are not in the Catholic Church, the miracles are connected to Father Capon because the families, the people around these victims who are suffering, pray to Father Capon. And because they were healed miraculously, those miracles are attributed to Father Capon. And have I got that right?
Tenery, very good. Two components to remember. A unexplained recovery that doctors and science cannot disprove. And that actually comes into the system. First on the ground, before you offer this as a miracle, you get local doctors, you talk to the local doctors. And, you know, in Avery's case, her doctor said, if you don't believe in miracles, you haven't met Avery Gerlman. Hmm. So there's one. And the second component is that this remarkable recovery happened because you asked your candidate directly, in this case, Father Capon, to intercede on the loved one's behalf. And what this proves is that he is at the right hand of the Father and has enough pull to intercede for those who prayed to him. And, you know, these are the two miracles, Tenery. Now, only one will be accepted. And again, this goes to why it takes so long. So once one or those other of those miracles are accepted, he will be beatified. He will be on step three. But then the clock starts again. The miracle that's going to make him a saint hasn't happened yet.
Explain that.
The second miracle has to be performed after the first miracle. So you can't say, here's three in the bag, let's short circuit it. You got to have the first one, and then you're beatified, and then the clock starts, life goes on.
So then another miracle has to occur after you're beatified.
Correct.
I got it.
It's that simple.
Mm. So there's nothing that can be done to rush the process. You've got to wait for that miracle, and then everything will be reconsidered again.
Absolutely.
Wow.
That is it. And, you know, in Mother Teresa and Pope John Paul, he went in 9 years. They were able to come up quickly with miracles. And this has opened a whole bag of worms in the church is, you know, why are miracles important? What really constitutes a miracle? And, you know, in fact, Pope Francis has canonized a handful of saints with only one miracle, basically saying, well, they were holy enough, they lived a holy enough life that it's good enough with one miracle. And so, you know, again, I think it'll evolve and maybe we'll go down to zero miracles.
Joe, you referred previously that to the fact that this whole process of studying about Father Capon and Father Hotze has strengthened your own faith. I wonder if you would just finally talk to us a little bit about that and your spiritual journey.
Well, you know, Tenery, I didn't even know I was in trouble spiritually. you know, I lived my life. My son goes to went to a Catholic grade school, is in an all boys Jesuit high school now. I'm a member of the community. I volunteer. I go to Mass. But I could tell when I was gathering disinformation that something was missing. I wasn't quite connecting with the material. And that made me, I hadn't lost my faith, but that made me start taking stock. And so I went back and read stuff that I came up to. I looked new places, all kinds of different faiths, looking for any inspiration. I found a little prayer book called Give Us This Day that I delved into. And finally, I went to a Jesuit priest. The Jesuits had been important in shaping my life. And we had lunch one day, and he said, you know, do you pray? And I said, well, yeah. And he said, how do you pray? And I said, Our Father's, Hail Mary's, the usual stuff. He says, what do you pray for? And I was like, I don't know, nothing really, great gratitude. And he said, you know, you got a teenage son. If he was worried or in trouble, don't you wish he would come and talk to you about it so you could help him? And I was like, sure. And he goes, well, that's the way God is. You know, you're supposed to talk to him about things that trouble you. And then he asked me a question that just I'm embarrassed to even repeat now. He's like, did you try praying to Father Capon? And here I had lived with this guy 8 years and it never occurred to me. Mm. And, you know, basically I had, you know, I'm a sports writer, so I'll use a sports metaphor. I had the yips like a golfer does. All of a sudden I couldn't make a 2-foot putt. I was just not connected. And that helped straighten me out. And yeah, I try to be very careful about this because faith is a very personal thing, and I'm by no means saved, and I'm not a better person, but I try to be a better person. And what I'd learned out of it is, you know, it is worth the effort to try to be present in minutes, hours, daily, and have an authentic spiritual dialogue with the higher power, no matter who it is or what faith you are. And, you know, when you're juxtaposed to a guy like Father Capon, who, you know, greatest gift was he saw the goodness in others and was able to exude his own goodness. And, you know, I fail miserably to that standard. I mean, you know, I have more bad days than good days, but it's important to try to have those good days.
Exactly. I think we're all there, right there with you. Well, Joe Drape is the author of The Saint Makers, Inside the Catholic Church and How a War Hero Inspired a Journey of Faith. Thank you so much for sharing your story and the story of Emil Capon.
Thanks so much, Tenery.
One of the most important, most useful inventions of antiquity was the composite bow. Sleek, rapid-firing, accurate, deadly. It took different forms, of course, in different civilizations. Tomorrow here on the show, we're going to talk about the past and present of this contraption with a man who makes them using traditional materials. And if these bows are composite, we're going to learn what to use to compose them with. That's tomorrow here on Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Our show is a production of BYU Radio.